You have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
Hey everybody, Jason here, Business Broker Growth Show. Today I have with me my business broker friend. I like to call him my friend. We've had many conversations. He even sent me his books, Richard Mowry. He is the president of Management Services and Development Limited. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm super excited that you're here. It's interesting, and we're going to go into a lot of stuff with you here on the show and in a conversation, but you've been in the business for a long time. You and I have had several conversations, and I feel like you were one of the initial brokers that I spoke with a few times, engaged with when I was, you know, kind of starting this journey with business brokers and business broker growth. And I remember when you sent me your books and you're just like, here's these as a resource. How can I help other brokers? What can we do? Like, I just want to help people. And so I'm super excited for this moment where you're on the show. So for people who might not know who you are, I'm going to tell people how long you've been doing this business broker game with valuations and all the stuff that you do, and a little bit about the path to get here.
Happy to be with you. There are a lot of people that helped me along the way as well, Jason, both brokers and good client, good business owner clients. So, you know, it all works together, and hopefully we can provide a little bit of information about what did and didn't work for other people to benefit from. So I started after I'd sold three manufacturing businesses over my career back in the late 1980s. Started doing valuations really for something to do initially after I departed. I hadn't planned as well, and that's one of the things I learned is that you need to help business owners plan that next phase of their life after their business is sold. And that worked out well, though, because it was something I enjoyed and began to learn, and that led into the transaction business where I could develop an investment banking adjunct and then spend more and more time in the investment banking side, helping business owners transition out of their business into the next phase of their lives.
So with that part, so you sold those manufacturing businesses, got into valuation, something to do. Let's take a pause before we keep going down the path of what you're focused on now, because I think it's interesting because I hear this a lot from business brokers as a challenge something they face is that business owner who hasn't planned and or isn't ready or hasn't thought about it. Maybe their identity has just been business or whatever they've been doing, or they just haven't thought about it yet.
It's a big part of a transaction that isn't focused on by enough professionals and certainly by owners. You know, owners have their heads down working on the operation, doing things, making things the way they want them. And they really don't step back and think about what it is that their next phase should be and where, how they can contribute. And actually, the fifth chapter in my first book, it's called The Hardest Part. That's the title of the chapter. Because for many business owners, it is the hardest part. Getting the business ready for sale on a relative basis, sometimes much easier. So I had a transaction years ago where we closed on a Thursday afternoon. It was out of state from where I am or where I was at that time and where I am now. And, you know, by Sunday night, the wife is on the phone with me. Richard, you got to help me. I said, what's wrong? And I used her name. And she says, he follows me into the kitchen. If I go out to, you know, water the plants, he follows me out to water the plants. she says, he's driving me nuts. You got to come help me. I said, well, what do you want me to do? She says, you just got to come help me. I said, okay, I'll fly down next week and we'll see what we can do. So we went out to lunch, the three of us. And, you know, I said to him, I said, how's it going? And she's over there. It's terrible. And he says, oh, yeah, things are going good. And she's going, no. So we had a nice chat. And, you know, he said, you know, would you like to get a part-time job? He says, well, I can't do that with my non-compete. I said, sure you can, as long as it's within the, you know, the right realm. So, you know, is there something? He says, yeah, well, there's such and such. I said, well, why don't you make a plan to find one of those part-time jobs in the next couple weeks, and then look for one or two charities where you might share your expertise. He says, oh, that's a good idea. Maybe I could do it. See, bright guy, hard worker, 24/7 for 35 years, but he hadn't thought about these things. So it took him about 6 months to kind of get readjusted. And she was eventually happy with the transition. And 2 years later, he stopped his part-time job and spent all his time on the two or three local charities and made a real significant difference. So been better, a little better for the transition if he'd made that plan earlier. But it worked out in the end.
It's funny because I'm laughing, thinking about my parents, not business owners, but, you know, hardworking at companies for long periods of time. Retirement came up years ago. And my mom was like, I'm really nervous because I don't think this is going to go well. Right. Being home and around each other. And my dad traveled a lot for work, and my mom would make the most of that time and liked her alone time. And it's funny because they had that serious concern. She was like, oh my gosh, why are we both going to make it after being together for a really long time? And then they found like they really do well, and they both stay busy. And my dad has some hobbies, but yeah, it's fascinating too, because the one thing I hadn't thought about, which you when you're talking about this story, is like, usually I think about the identity, and I've talked about on the show with other guests, is that the identity of that business owner as the business owner, as the employer of people, the leader in the community, things like that, right? And then, but the part I don't think about is, what about that, the hardworking aspect, right? Now, even if it's separated from the identity, but like that person who's just a hard worker, they just like working and they don't sit well. And now all of a sudden they're retired and they're sitting. And it's like, okay, now what do I do with my time? You know, it's not just identity, but you know, that part. I'm sure that's
identity
tough.
Is part of it for sure. And you know, many business owners do struggle with that. You know, they're certainly the leader of their business and the person that everyone looks to for the big decisions and making things happen. But they also have that position in the community as the owner of XYZ company that employs 150 people and, you know, and contributes a lot to different parts of the community. So, you know, that transition, when you don't have that, you know, nominal title anymore, does have an effect on some people, not everybody, but it's certainly something to take a look at and think about, because it is different, but it doesn't need to have to be significantly different in terms of whether you can contribute.
And so what have you found as you've gone through your journeys? You've worked with lots of business brokers in one capacity or another, and just being supportive. Like, what are the things that business brokers can do to help with that portion of the process?
I think it's pretty simple in that we tend to focus on getting the business ready, because I mean that's the tacit product that you're selling, if you will. But when, and the average business broker, and I was included in that until I learned a little better, you know, doesn't talk a lot about this part of the transition. But in the end, you need to get the business ready for the sale, and you need to get the business owner ready for the sale. And then hopefully you develop that in a way that they're both ready when the market for the business, the type of business that you're going to sell, is also ready. When those three things line up, things go pretty smoothly. If the business owner isn't as ready for the sale, you know, things don't happen the way you think they might. And, you know, I've seen and counseled some brokers at times and said, I'm having trouble with this transaction. Help me, Richard. And I said, what's wrong? He says, well, we had everything. I've got the price. Actually, he said, I have a better price than we talked about for the owner. He says, he just is fussing about the price, or is concerned about this. And has, I said, this really has nothing to do with price. And I said, he's just not ready. You didn't spend enough time with him to get him ready for this transition, because it's emotional. It's a change, like you just mentioned about their not the leader of the company more. And he may not have. So spend a little more time on that. And if he's not ready, you may have to just delay things until he is, because there's no use working through and frustrating everybody in the deal until that's done. So This particular broker certainly learned that lesson, and as I, from a distance, I can see his deals are running much smoother now. And it's just a matter of taking that time to do something that the business owner's not thinking about, and sometimes the broker's not thinking about to the level that it's important.
And so my background is in sales and marketing. And so I've spent a lot of time studying sales, studying people, and then also helping coach and train people on the sales aspect and just really focusing on that. And it's interesting because what you're saying, I would align in a normal sales process with the discovery part, where it's like, if you don't know what somebody wants and why at the deepest level, then it's never going to work out, right? There's going to be objections, there's going to be issues, there's going to be reasons why that potential customer doesn't want to move forward. And it's fascinating how it's all human related, because in what you're talking about, it's like, if you don't do enough discovery as a business broker with that owner of what they want and why, and not just I want to exit and then have money, but like why, and then tie it into the identity and solve all of that and really go into therapist mode, like you're going to run up against these things that on the surface feel like transactional barriers, but they're not, right? They're the human element getting in the way.
There's something that isn't what's being stated, and that's the way you have to diagnose it and then solve the problem. If you haven't covered that in discovery, that's a good word for you to use on at an earlier time. So.
Yeah. And you know, this is what I've always told people, is that if you don't know why, not what, but if you don't know why somebody wants what you're offering, in this case here, we talk about business owners and brokers. If you don't know why they want to exit at the deepest level, don't assume they know why, because most likely they don't know why either they want to buy from you or get your help. And so if you don't know, they probably don't know, and that's going to cause a problem later on. So, I think that's so important over the years. So you've gone from business brokers to more value. I mean, valuation, and then the brokerage,
right?
And then kind of more back to the valuation focus, yeah. Right?
Yeah, started doing valuations and did those for probably only about 2 years before I got into transactional work, because it was pretty clear to me that that was where I could deliver more benefit to people with my own personal experience, plus the valuation knowledge that I gained with the help of a lot of good people, you know, from Ray Miles, who originally, you know, I must have talked to him 200 times in those 2 years. And Ray never answered a single question, but he made me think and he made me find the answer. He was a fabulous mentor, and he made a lot of difference. I was blessed with a lot of people like that. So, but then, you know, I could then begin to help people with this transition. And it is all about early preparation, both for the business and the owner.
And so what does that early prep mean, especially when it comes to the valuation piece, which I know is something we're going to talk a lot
well,
about?
Well, I learned a little belatedly, to use evaluation work in a different way. I was struggling with a couple of the early transactions that you know, I'd had some things close and seemed to work out well, and some others I was struggling with. And I was at a industry conference at the M&A Source, and Frank Bean, a gentleman from Maine who was the president of M&A Source at the time, we were chatting over lunch, and he says, "How's it going?" I told him. He says, "Richard," he says, "think about what you know." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You know how to do valuation work. You're good at it. You've proven that. And you're having trouble with poor price expectations of your clients." He says, "You know, just require a separate engagement of valuation. Do the work. You'll deliver value there. They'll know where the value is and probably where they can do some, you know, cleanups, improvement to increase the value over time, and get the right timing for the sale of the business at a price that they know that they can accept and one that you can achieve." Well, you know, once we did that, we just put those separate valuation engagements as a beginning point for client work. You know, we closed over 90% of our transactions when we finally took them to market. Now, they didn't all go to market in the next year. I had one great client who's still a personal friend took us 11 years between the first time we did the valuation and we decided together that it was time to market the business and did some updates. And he did a number of things in the meantime to dramatically increase the value of his business until he was ready personally and the business was really ready and was significantly more value than it was originally. But it's a good process and it works. Work for me, and I could work for other people in this business. And it certainly works for the business owners because they get a good picture early of what drives value, where they are, and really what the net is that they're going to walk away from after the transaction. Too many people focus on the price. It's not the price. It's what is there after taxes and fees and payment of the debt that's on the book. So, you know, that picture and the understanding of it gives an owner something really tangible to work on, think about, and to make the right decision whether to go forward at that time or to wait, make things a little different before they start.
How many times or how, I don't even know what the right parameter would be. Just thinking about that last part that you were talking about with what is the net that an owner is going to get on an estimated basis, you know, based on it's not not the top line that matters, it's the bottom line.
Right.
Like how many owners are going into the exit transaction process or deep into the process and have this number in their mind of what they're walking away with, but it's not accurate. And then it blows things up.
There's just typically a lot of focus on the price. Mm. And, you know, when you're talking price in a transaction, you're talking about invested capital, which is a term that business owners aren't, you know, typically familiar with. It's all the capital that's invested in the business, which is the equity plus the debt. If you think of it like owning a house, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to buy a $500,000 home. You bring $100,000 in down payment. That's your equity. And you borrow $400,000. That's your debt. 7 years later, you decide to sell the house. It's worth $600,000. And you still owe $330,000. So you're not going to walk away with $600,000. You're going to walk away with $600,000 minus $330,000, $270,000. And if it was a taxable event, that would be reduced by maybe a third in taxes. So you'd walk away with 180, not 600,000. The same is true in a business transaction.
Yeah, and where the focus on the top line, and it's interesting too because I think that follows what a lot of people do. The humans and business humans, especially sales humans, like to do, which is the top line numbers, not the bottom line numbers, right? Where you just look at that. And I, it's funny, I laugh because I feel like Shark Tank taught a whole generation of people what really matters, which is, hey, your business sold $3 million in widgets. That's great. How much did you profit? I profited $9, right? Like the what somebody like the top line number versus like the bottom line number, which is all that technically matters. And where, you know, there's the revenue, there's the EBITDA, there's all those things. And where, you know, those conversations for owners to be like, here's what you're going to walk away with. And then, you know, here's all the factors that go into that. And I'm sure that's not an easy conversation sometimes because people probably have a number, which is like, I need X number of dollars to retire or to ride off into the sunset.
Well, and if they do know that number, they're ahead of some people. Not everybody knows that number. You know, if they want $200,000 in annual cash flow to live the lifestyle they want after retirement, you know, they need to have an understanding that they probably need $5 million of investable funds to be able to have that kind of cash flow. So if they've got $300,000 in all of their investments outside their personal, outside their home, they're going to need better part of $4.7 million more to bridge that gap. And if their business is worth $3 million, they're not there yet. They've got to. And so once they know those two numbers, what they really need to satisfy that retirement cash flow and what the current value of the business is, that gap is right there in front of them. And that's their job to fill that gap to get there and to so that they can have the retirement that they worked hard for and that they deserve.
Yeah. So one of the things you said a little bit ago, going backwards, is that, you know, 90, you and your focus, you know, 90%+ of the businesses that you took to market sold, right?
Right.
But you didn't necessarily take every business to market, which again, anybody who's listened to the show enough knows that, you know, talking to brokers is that, you know, if you're not taking everyone to market for certain reasons, like for that, what are those reasons generally that something is like not ready from a value standpoint? Is it like what they're going to net and get away, walk away with? Like when it comes to the valuation part, where like your friend who waited 11 years, like, you know, right. what are some factors, especially business owners listening to this, that would help them understand?
There's any number of reasons that you would step back and not take a business to market at any particular time. And, you know, some of it's price oriented, like because the gap is there and the business needs to have some changes made. You know, the other things are the type of business sometimes and the owner's orientation. Many owners who do very well for themselves in the business really do run the business as a one man or one woman show. And those businesses are very difficult to transfer. And if they're not disposed to change their operating style, someone else may want to take it to market, but I wouldn't. You know, I would say no, that your business isn't transferable enough. It's going to be potentially difficult for the next person to run it like you, unless you're willing to put in systems, hire some other management, you know, diversify your customer base a little more, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's not a transaction that I would be comfortable presenting to someone to invest their hard-earned money in and become the next owner. So that, you know, that owner orientation is something that you always look at, what they're doing, and can that business operate if they take a month's vacation.
and it's interesting because you and I spoke about this in the past, which is the E-Myth Revisited as a principle and a really good example. And I think there's also Robert Kiyosaki's cash flow quadrant, where it talks about like the four levels of business, like a job, and then it's like something else, and then a business, and then an investment. And when you get to that third layer with something, it's like you being gone, the business will actually do better without you being present, right? And that's the level you want. Like, you still have to be involved, right? There's no absentee business that's just going to run forever. But like, if you take that month off, everyone knows what to do. The systems are in place. Right. Everything is good. It might actually do better. You know, it might still keep going up and to the right. And, you know, I think that the challenge is that so many people start businesses because they want to start a business, but they're not planning this, you know, exit strategy.
Right. And, you know, you're right. Sometimes if you get good management, train them well, and let them, their ideas and strengths show through, the business can really thrive. That's not always the case, but typically that can happen. And, you know, owners, you know, find that hard to do at times, and particularly in family businesses. I've worked a number of succession plans for different people in family businesses, and the founder, who may have started when they were 16 with a pickup truck and now have a business employing 200 people, you know, just aren't sure that, you know, Bobby or Joey or Susie or Sally are going to be able to do it like he did. And it turns out that, you know, two of those four really have good ideas and good skills and will take the business to a whole different level in a whole different way. But dad's got to first believe that, and then two, hand some of that responsibility and authority over so it happens. And again, it's emotional. It's difficult because, again, when you start with essentially nothing other than an ambition and build something of significant value that's important to the community, important to a lot of people who have jobs there, you're reticent to do anything that might fracture that and might make it what is today down the road tomorrow. And so this succession in families is hard, but it's important. And you know, probably the most important thing I learned there doing a number of those is that in the end, let's say there's four children, and they're all going to be in the business. One of them needs to be clearly in charge. And usually you can figure out who that is. And dad or mom, who's ever businesses is, will kind of know that too. So it's a matter of facilitating an ownership structure that properly wards everybody, but also makes it so decisions can be made. Because the last thing you want is to have, you know, four people making decisions on a joint basis that end up with, you know, the average poor decision on more often than not. So, you know, those are things you learn and important principles to apply. And you can make it equitable for the other people who are working and contributing. They're happier, their families, they can do what they need and want for their families. And the business can do extremely well and grow dramatically under that kind of management.
Yeah, I'll make a blanket statement. I'm sure there's probably examples of why it's not correct, but most organizations will not succeed in the long term.
If you're listening to this and thinking, I need this level of authority, I just don't have time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. That's what we do here. We build that whole thing for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and the authority signals, everything we've talked about here on the podcast. So if you want to add impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it could look like for your business.
Most organizations will not succeed in the long term if consensus is required for decision making, right? An organization meaning a family unit, a business, a volunteer club, like whatever that is, like it can't just be consensus required all the time, because that's just going to be the average, or people are just going to, you know, go with what others are suggesting, and somebody's really got to lead, and then everyone's got to, you know, be on board. So I think that's interesting. And I think that, you know, the stats are out there generally where family-based businesses, you know, struggle more, you know, second, third generation down.
Right. There aren't many fourth and fifth generation family businesses, unfortunately. But no, they can be. If people would work at it and think about some of these principles we're discussing. And, you know, I can count on my one left hand the number of fourth generation family businesses that I'm aware of. But they're there and they've done well for the entire family all those years. But it took a special leader originally to do that and to make sure that that next generation had a leader. And that they knew that that principle was important and that they would continue doing that as time went on. So,
yeah. How, on my roadmap in my mind of all the stuff I want to talk about, let's go here next, which is how often do you see times where the business owner is not planning the exit, doesn't plan, and it is then facilitated or required either from a crisis or the passing of a founder?
I haven't seen it terribly often, fortunately.
Good.
But inside the business area, we talk about the dismal D's, which are something that every business owner should be aware of, plan for, and have mitigations for. You know, that's business distress, obviously, divorce, disability, and death. And, you know, we don't, all of us, like to think about any of those things. But it's important to, you know, death's an easy one to plan for. You can have life insurance in place that will first fund the business for a period of time so that that new successor who may not be there has some time and money to get things moving. And life insurance for the family so that the family unit can stay intact and function. Disability is a difficult one. I've had situations where I had owners who I was working with get in some car wrecks. And, you know, they're in the hospital for a lengthy period of time. They finally came out of it. But those things you need to plan for. So, you know, having disability insurance, having a good will in place, having the other planning done is important. And hopefully when you're picking your number one advisor, your spouse, you've been lucky to pick the right one and you don't have to address that particular situation because that's a difficult one.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you haven't seen that too many times. I've heard some stories from other brokers where they've ended up in some scenarios where business owner came to them, tried to, you know, gave them the information. They said they wanted to sell. They held off. Next thing you know, years later, they get a call from the spouse saying something happened. And now what do you do? Or the kids. And it's like, now what do we do? How much can we get for this? And then that's, you know, that's a difficult one for sure.
I saw one of those early in my life. I think I was 11 or 12. I had a good friend whose father had a really nice welding business, employed about 50 people. And he died very prematurely, very suddenly. And there was no management in place. And mom, you know, because of my age, most moms at that time were stay-at-home moms and they took care of us. She tried as she could, and I watched it happen. She tried to run the business and do things, tried to get people to come in and help her. And after the better part of a year, it just she couldn't make it work. So she closed the business, sold the assets, and moved away. And, you know, at the time, what I was focused on was that she took my friend with her. And at 12 years old, losing one of your better friends is where you're focused. But as I reflected back on it, was because he didn't have the planning in place. He didn't have the life insurance for the family, didn't have the life insurance, and certainly didn't have the second level management team in place to run the business effectively, who knew the customers, knew how to hire and train. You know, welding is a real skill set. And it was a specialty business. So, you know, that's a memory that stayed with me and kind of enlightened me as I got into some of these things later on.
And what's fascinating, not to focus on the age thing, but we're talking about a time where I feel like maybe someone who started a business, the dad with the welding business, and you start a business. The college degrees back then wasn't necessarily a thing. So you have this path, you could start a business. If you've got this skill that you can transfer and start a thing. And so thinking of succession planning, thinking of management structures, thinking of systems and processes, like I feel like it's now more prevalent and there's more information about that.
I think there's kind of know, more of awareness awareness. And you mentioned the E-Myth, which I believe is one of the most important books written if you just get the basics from it, which is work on your business, not in it. And that working on it means what you just mentioned, Jason, developing good systems, you know, putting second tier management in place, diversifying your customer base, you know, working in a segment of industry where there's growth, and then getting a strong financial balance sheet to withstand those dismal days if and when they might occur.
Yeah. And what's also interesting is that all this stuff you said, like the awareness and more education, more books, there's just more resources out there, right? Like think of pre-internet, pre-business books. Just think of what was available, you know, in the last 30, 40, 50 years, and then think of what's available now. Yet your industry, business brokerage and business valuation, has a huge issue with awareness and education where so many business owners still don't even know it exists, right? Like still don't even know that there's some planning for it and then there is ways to exit.
Yeah, exactly. And what I learned over time was to look for business owners who exhibited a hunger to learn. And if I found a business owner who had a hunger to learn, he or she was going to be a really good client for me because they would hear most of what I said and put most of it to work. And I could help them bridge that difference between the little here and there. And, you know, you see a lot of owners like that. That's why they are owners of nice sized machine shops or other places, but they're the 24-year-old that a new machine was brought into the machine shop and everybody was afraid of it because it had too many bells and whistles, and they raised their hand and said, I'd be happy to learn how to run that.
Yeah.
And then on and on. So, you know, brokers can look for little clues and to find the type of owners that they can service best. That was the type of owner that made a difference in how I was able to help them. They had that hunger to learn and had always been the person leaning forward to do something to get more knowledge. Then they were going to be able to gain from what I had to offer them and maybe dramatically increase the value of the business. I told different people over the years that you can double or triple the value of your business, and people lean back and they don't quite believe that. The metrics, once you understand the Gordon growth model and some of the metrics, it isn't that hard to really have a significant impact on value over a relatively short period of time. I'm not talking about weeks or months, but over a couple of years, you can dramatically increase the value of a business doing things that affect it to reduce risks as perceived by buyers and to increase that cash flow. And the beauty of doing those things is that you have a more profitable business and one typically that's much easier to manage today. And certainly it's going to be worth significantly more someday when you decide it is time for that ownership transfer.
Yeah. And we'll talk about valuation in a minute, but I love what you were talking about, the hunger to learn. It's that growth mindset I have found for the longest period of time is that the best clients to work with, the ones that I have worked with well, or if I've ever been in a sales role, like the people who, you know, become good clients or customers or are interested, is the ones who have that growth mindset where they don't think they know everything. They don't think they're smarter than everyone else. They don't think they've solved everything. And they want to learn. They know there's more, and they're always just eager, right? Not always just want to make more money, just want to learn, interested in ideas. Those to me have always been the best people to work with because they know that they don't know everything. And then hopefully with that growth mindset, they also take action on what you're telling them to do or what they're, you know, asking you to help with.
That's the other big secret to successful business people. I read a book by Dan Kennedy years ago. It's a little tiny book, and you read the whole book. And what Dan says, if you want to succeed, take action. So I read the whole book to learn to be reminded of that. So you're exactly right. Gaining knowledge is just the first step.
Yeah.
It doesn't do you any good unless you formulate the best way to use it to take action.
Absolutely. So let's talk about valuation. Otherwise, we'll keep talking about humans for the whole show. So when it comes to the value, one of the things that I'm curious about is been doing this for quite some time, right? Like you referenced exiting the three manufacturing businesses and getting into valuations. Has much changed in the art and the science of valuation since then? Obviously, there's the technology and the speed and what you can do to calculate it. That's probably easier now than it was then. But like, is the fundamentals of value for a business just perpetually the same?
The basic principles are exactly the same. You know, there are three approaches: the asset approach, the market approach, and the income approach. And you know, those really, when applied by an effective practitioner with all the right information, are going to lead you to the right range of value. The difference today is, as you had referenced earlier, people are more knowledgeable about a lot of things about business, about, you know, systems and management and so forth. And they have some knowledge about valuation. So it's easier to begin to communicate some of these things than it might have been 30 or 40 years ago. More people have enough of a financial baseline today that you can explain what invested capital is and then give a good definition, as we discussed earlier, and then go from there. Because when people are talking about price, they're talking about invested capital, they're not talking about equity. And, you know, when you're looking at the public markets, it's all equity discussions, price earnings ratios. Mm-hmm. Well, in the business valuation world, you're looking at return on entire invested capital, that's debt and equity. And you're looking for that risk rate of return that matches the risk in the business as it's perceived and analyzed by the buyer. The ultimate risk factor that's applied to a business that generates a value, a price, is the risk of the buyer. The buyer is going to look at the owner's business and say, okay, you've got a 30% customer, that's risky. You know, You don't have second tier management in all the functional areas, just in marketing. That adds risk. So, you know, they may have started with a 15% rate of return by the time they adjust for some of their, what they perceive as risks. You know, that it might be 20 or 22%. And, you know, now you can mitigate some of those things, or, you know, can have a good contract in place and do a lot of things. You can sell a business with customer concentration. I sold a number with customer concentration, which typically is a big discount factor, but it's a matter of showing the buyer that there's certainly risk there, and that, but it's been mitigated. Here's why: that customer has very little place to go that has all of the, excuse me, has all of the same things in place that he's getting with service at this current business. So you can do that without question. But you got to first know the facts and make sure the facts are accurate, and that is now you may have to, and we've certainly done it. We have an earnout structure, and if the owner's confident with an earnout structure, say, okay, that customer will be here 3 years from now at the same sales or more. You can do a structure that where actually the owner might actually benefit, get a higher price in total, and the buyer has their risk concerns, you know, mollified with that structure. But typically you can work through that. Now, the best solution obviously is to take that 30% customer and grow the business and get other customers so that it's only 18%, you know. So
yeah. And you said something in passing. It was super quick. And missed is like one of those things that this people might not hear, is that based on data and facts, as far as like what goes into it, right. One of the things that I know, and I can only imagine how many times you've seen this in your career, because I know how many times I've heard about this as like a horror story, which you could call the country club valuation, the back of the napkin, the story somebody hears from somebody else where they sold a business that's probably not even similar, but they got a whole ton of money. And so that should be what mine is worth.
Right. Yeah. That does occur certainly, but again, they have no idea whether there was, you know, half of that selling price had to be paid down in debt, and it didn't get to have a good transaction structure. So there was a significant amount of tax paid. You know, that $10 million country club price might have meant that the person walked away with $1.8 million, you know?
Yeah. And had to stay on for years.
Well, right? And it wasn't enough for retirement. They decided that they would go work for somebody else. So, you know, knowing the facts is, you know, what you want to do as a broker, and you want to understand the facts if you're an owner, and then you put those things together with the knowledge that each has, and you can get a good plan to go from here to that someday sale.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's obviously the goal, I know, for every broker out there is to get into a conversation with a business owner years in advance of an exit so that all of those things can be level set, and the good strategy, like you said, is to have that timeline. What have you found? And maybe this is what we do. Actually, we'll hold that for the marketing side. Now, one thing I know when you and I spoke recently is that, you know, talking about like market observations of what's going on in the business broker M&A space. Like, obviously, you've seen a lot over the years. What's the current year trend you're seeing for maybe price, deal volume? What kind of things have you noticed recently?
Well, your analyst, the technology and the ability to employ technology has changed this business over the 35 plus years that I was in it. You know, the reports that would have cost $50,000 in the 1990s, you can get by tapping a few things on your desktop and paying a couple $100 today. So the for advisors, brokers, and valuators, you know, there's a level playing field. And there's a lot more things you can do consequently for your customer because you don't have those cost hurdles that are insurmountable to provide that service. So I think the wide variety of advisors, financial planners, brokers, evaluators can provide more information, and that the owners, if they're astute, can be collecting all that and make themselves much better prepared. So I think this is a time where preparation should be improving. Transactions, as I've been kind of trying to monitor things, appear to be getting larger, but there are fewer of them. And so I think that it's interesting. We talk about the K-shaped economy, if you're an economist on TV these days, that you, I think there's that's happening in the, particularly with manufacturing companies where I spent the majority of my time. The private equity groups who are a large buying group of those businesses are looking for larger transactions, but they're doing fewer of them. And part of the reason is if you look at their holding periods, their holding periods have extended a year or two. So they're holding their portfolio companies. They're not turning them over. So they're not looking for as many transactions, but they're looking for bigger ones because of that. So I'd encourage brokers to, you know, encourage your business owners to, you know, develop that growth pattern so that they'll be more in the area that will be interested to the potential buying group, and to, you know, try to focus on providing service for larger businesses because they'll be easier to sell because that's where the buyers are today.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's interesting how that works, especially with the private equity influence and the other things that come into play with that. And just wondering, you know, deal volume, is that a reflection of businesses just not being ready enough for the market and with what buyers are looking for and buyers? And I'm sure this has also changed because I know technology and gurus out there has helped it a lot, but where the buyers are way more educated and way more armed with information about what they're looking for and want to buy, kind of going back to your, you know, owner dependency mode. That's not what buyers are looking for.
Absolutely not. And private equity groups as a group of buyers they're professionals. They are good at buying businesses, and they have learned how to be good at operating them. And, you know, back in the 1980s, before there were a lot of private equity groups around, you know, the market for mid-sized businesses was more constricted than we remember. Private equity groups, and, you know, they get negative press periodically, particularly because there's some huge private equity groups that are public companies on Wall Street doing all kinds of different things. The vast majority of private equity groups are good, solid people with a lot of integrity, and they have provided a much more active market for mid-sized businesses in the U.S. Certainly, still a large number of businesses are purchased by individuals or group of individuals and or strategic buyers, other businesses who want to acquire that business because of some process, some product, some market, maybe even a group of critical employees. We saw that in this AI world that we're all watching now. Mm-hmm. Some of those acquisitions were really about acquiring the five or six technical guys and gals who were, you know, the inner part of the engine for the business that was acquired. So, you know, those things are different. Being aware of who the buyers are in the market is important. Brokers certainly, you know, spend a lot of time doing that. And that's one of the things they bring to the table for business owners to discuss that, because the transactions, the buyers do make a difference. If you're looking at a legacy in your business, in your community, and you find a strategic buyer who's doing a roll up, you know, acquiring other businesses to make a much larger business, they might be disposed to close your business and transfer that sales to another location. Mm-hmm. So you certainly want to be asking those questions. You want to be aware of that. They may pay a higher price than a financial buyer, a private equity group, but the end result will be different. So understanding those and really developing a preference for the kind of transactions that you want, and whether sometimes it's better just to sell part of the business and to maintain the retain part for a number of years, you know, looking at all those things and sorting those out to get ready for that transaction is part of what the owner should be doing and the advisor should be helping them do.
Yeah, I think that's great. I love all that. And again, I think this is just more of why, you know, I love these conversations and why we do the work that we do and help the brokers that we do is like just to get more and more of this out there, more of this awareness and education, where despite the fact that we're in this information age, it's still a lot of stuff that, you know, business owners don't seem to know or get to early enough in the process so that they can plan and go through all this. So, all right, let's move into the next part of the show, which is the broker growth tips. So obviously you've been playing this game for a long time. You've seen a lot, you've done the transactions, you've gone to the valuation side. And I think, you know, it's in that realm of what business brokers are wanting to do, which again, going back to what I was just saying, is that the awareness and the education piece and what can brokers do to basically get themselves out there more, fill their pipeline, get more conversations with business owners. Like when you think of your list of what is valuable that you've seen, what do you have on the list?
Well, we talked about finding that hunger to learn. I used to ask the question, and brokers can do this, just ask your prospect, what do you like to read? You learn something about it. They may read sports, so you can make a connection there. You may find out they read business periodicals or they read mysteries. A mystery reader is someone who's looking for thinking about diagnosis and figuring things out. So, you can make those assertions of whether they have that hunger to learn, but also you can pick up a lot about the individual so that you can connect and begin to build that trust. Now, in terms of the best way to start up the ladder of trust is with referrals. Mm. 90% of our clients came from referrals, and we nurtured that with a number of different things, a newsletter, different things, simply asking for things. You know, there's a book that says, you know, ask and you shall receive. You know, you're not going to get referrals unless you ask for them. But you want to ask for them in a particular. You want to ask for them in a way that the referrer knows you're going to provide real value to the person they're referring, and that then properly structured. You know, particularly if it's an attorney or a CPA, that there'll be some mutual benefit down the road for everybody involved. So, you know, I think developing a solid referral base, working on that. I had an early mentor told me, you know, when I wanted to know how to develop my business and I was trying every marketing method under the sun and only a few were working. He says, just spend all your time having breakfast or lunch with referral sources. And, you know, get to know them, get them to know you, get to know them, what benefits you can provide to their clients, and then ask for those referrals. And once I did that, things really did change. And I'd encourage brokers to do that in their business. They'll have that farm team out there ready to, you know, bring in, and you'll be able to, you know, work with clients that are more ready, typically growing, and will provide larger transactions for you to work on. So,
yeah, I think that's always good. And I think it's always important to do. And then what I see a lot is you've got to think about both, right? I call it the hunting and the farming. And you talk about the farm team out there. But like referrals is a long game. It's unpredictable. You don't know when they're going to happen. And it usually takes a lot of time to build the network and the trust and the relationship where someone's going to trust their client or friend or, you know, connection with you. And so like, that's the farming. It's a long game. Usually you have to eat today. And so it's like, but you got to do that. And so many people I see, business brokers, salespeople in general, they need to eat today. And so they're not planting those seeds. They're not building the farm, and they're going from transaction to transaction to transaction, like the, you know, the full up and down swings, and they're not stopping enough or investing enough in the farm mode, which is difficult.
Absolutely. One of the difficult things about the brokerage investment banking business is you know, you're doing a transaction that takes 600, 800 hours and you're consumed by it. You're not doing the marketing work during that period of time because you're focused on getting the deal properly done for your client. So having systems in place and processes that keep things moving so that you don't have those gaps like too many business brokers do have between those really good transactional opportunities and the next one, putting those in place will make a big difference in how their business runs, and it'll dramatically increase their growth of their business over time.
Yeah. And obviously anyone listening to this that's a business broker already knows this, but then you add in the element where just because you're working on the transaction for 600 to 800 hours doesn't mean it's actually going to close and you're going to make money from that either, right? Like even if you have a really high percentage, like you talked about 90, the brokers out there at 95%, that still means a margin of people, like deals and time spent in like from the listing phase on where there's no revenue from it.
Things can happen.
And
I mean, we talked about the dismal D's, you know, if heaven forbid, you know, the economy turned down. You know, I was working on some tractions back in 2008, two to be exact. And we closed one of those. The other one we didn't close because when they turned the light switch out, you know, buyers weren't anywhere to be found. Well, luckily for one of the transactions, we had a buyer that could see their way through it, and we structured a deal that worked well for everybody. But you know, things do happen like that. And so, you know, brokers and business owners need to be aware that, you know, if you have something moving and you can get it done, you want to get it done today, not a month from now, regardless of what the attorneys are telling you they have to do.
or the lender for the buyer and all the stuff that just needs to drag on.
And, you know, it's, you know, the great thing about being, a broker is that you can talk to everybody in the transaction. You know, attorneys are restricted to talking to the other legal counsel and so forth, but you can go talk to the lender, say, okay, what's the issue? Well, you know, maybe they didn't tell, you know, the CPA or the owner. Well, the issue is that, you know, there's $300,000 of personal debt on this business. We want that cleaned up. We don't want to do this deal and have, you know, have something happen that we don't know. You have to get down to the actual issue, and it's a broker's responsibility to do that. And, you know, things happen in transactions. Those last 60 or 90 days to the closing table, lots of things happen. And it's, you know, the broker with experience and with some insight and some, just some continuous effort can go in and solve those problems because they can talk to everybody and ask those questions and then find out. Because once you know the problem, unless it's who's going to get to own the Penn State tickets, which sometimes is more difficult, you can solve it. So, and with the Penn State tickets, we discovered if you just buy another set, we can make
another
work.
Set. That's it. Just buy more. Then that way there's nothing to fight over, right? Same thing with kids. Right.
Exactly.
Have enough. All right. Back to the growth strategies, marketing tips. What else do you have on that list?
We did some buyer searches, and where we would get into a buyer search, we would maybe do a transaction for somebody. And after they owned the business for a while, they wanted to grow the business by acquisition. Mm-hmm. And because they knew us from the transaction, you know, we were working for another party at the time, they would contact, say, Richard, you know this business, you helped sell it to us. We want to look for someone that'll fit. We think you can help us with that. And I would do those transactions when there wasn't any conflict with my, you know, prior client and with my prior client's written permission. But what I found was in doing those searches, there are a lot of people out there doing search work. Many of them are good at it. But not all. And so a good mid-sized business is getting inquiries by email or by phone or, you know, any number of ways. What we found work was an old-fashioned written letter that identified who the buyer is that I'm representing and that with the buyer's phone number in those letters, say, you know, this is who would like to talk to you confidentially about your business. Wow. If you're interested, you know, call me and I will either do a quick call, a virtual call back in the toward the end of my career, or we'll have lunch and talk about it. And we got a very high level response for that, and good quality people who were truly interested. Because once they saw you actually had a buyer, not a pretend buyer like mm-hmm. sometimes is done these days, and by putting the phone number in the letter where they can call that buyer and say, you know, is Richard really representing you? Do you really want to buy my business? And we would have shown a list of who we were going to send these letters to the buyer, and had them okay them before we did that. So it's a matter of building a structure that really honors the importance of every party in the potential transaction and treats them with that kind of respect.
That's amazing. I love that approach. And it's interesting too, to think about what cuts through the noise. And I've talked about it enough on the show too, when it's come to the marketing strategies and stuff I've written about online recently, where it's like, you know, people have more defense than you have offense when it comes right. to things like phone calls. Like, they don't have to answer. They can block you. Your number can be destroyed and come up as spam, like if you are doing things right. But no matter what, all of us, especially after a certain age, realize, no matter how much you don't want mail, junk mail, anything like that, you're going to get it. There's nothing you can do about
right.
it. So,
yeah. Well, the other thing I would suggest that the brokers can do, you know, is we would sort our target buyer list down pretty tightly. We didn't mail, you know, or mail or email 1,000 people for a right. transaction, you know, or even 500 or 300. You know, we would have sort that down to, you know, maybe three or four dozen, and we would put those in, talk to the seller about them and put them in groups of 12 or 15. And what we would do to get the attention of those people, sometimes it would depend, but typically we would send them an overnight. It was just a blind flyer at the time, but we would, and a cover letter saying, I represent this particular business. We think you would be a good potential buyer. Da, 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 da. Here's the particulars. The blind flyer would have been carefully structured, so it wouldn't reveal who the business was. But we would overnight those packages to people.
Wow.
And, you know, then you would you'd know they would land on the owner's desk, the person you were trying to get to. And that even worked, you know, when we were there are times we were looking for public companies as acquirers. In the end, I only did two transactions with public companies as buyers. But, you know, the brokers, that's another thing I should clearly make. Brokers should not preclude looking at public companies as acquirers, particularly for manufacturing and other businesses in the 8, 10, 12, $15 million range. There's a lot of public companies buy smaller businesses like that. And if they fit well regionally or by brand or by process or by product group, they will take a look at it. And, you know, you want, again, get to some of those public companies will have what they'll call a development group, which is really their internal brokerage action people. And if not them, you can find them, or, you know, send it right to the, you know, the president of the company. And if they're interested, they'll refer it to the right person and you'll hear from them. So, you know, shouldn't preclude looking at, in some cases, some public companies who might be good buyers. And, you know, we did that when it was appropriate, and I would encourage brokers to do that. I think you might find some really interesting acquirers that way. And the beauty about public companies is, you know, if they have done a number of acquisitions, I mean, they're all geared up, ready to go. It's not about, you know, fussing up and down and looking at different things. You know, they know what they want. You know, now their attorneys, you know what they want as well. So you've got to be ready to manage your way through that. And all the representations and warranties that are hard for business owners to look at, read, and sign. But, you know, I encourage brokers to look at that group of potential buyers.
I love it. I think that's great. Well, I appreciate all these growth tips. I know there's probably a ton more. Some will probably come up in the after show when we talk about kind of the future business brokerage and where you're at. We're also going to cover, because I know you and I are going to keep talking after this, we're going to talk about the deal that got away, which I'm sure 30 plus years, you have an infinite number of stories of deals that should have closed, but
not,
didn't.
Not too many, but some.
No, not well, you know, it's a different, in my mind, I guess there's the category of the like listed and doesn't happen. Then there's the should have happened. And then there's the, you know, other people and things, especially if you look at your valuations on and what people decisions people right. make. So I guess that's where my mind goes because of, you know, you have a good percentage. But for people who want to get in touch with you, like I mentioned, you have several books. You've sent me a bunch. Here's the ones that I have. I love these as a resource. I think, you know, what you're doing and content and even being here for anyone that knows you, you're semi-retired, so you're really like, you came on the show with me today because you just wanted to give back, like you said early on, and share so much stuff. So people tuning in, they want to learn more from you. They want to find out any of your resources. They could probably, you know, also find the books. I know the website is richmowrey.com, M-O-W-R-E-Y. Link will be in the show notes. They can find you on LinkedIn. There's also the mergermentor.com website. And so we'll have everything in there. And Rich, I just appreciate you being here and wanting to give back. I think that's huge. It's one of the things I really love about so many business brokers that I encounter is that because it's kind of a small community, no matter what, and because there's more deals than there are good brokers out there. Like there's so much that's shared back and forth. And I just appreciate you for all of that.
Well, a lot of people help me along the way. And if to the extent I can do that even a little bit for both business owners and for brokers, I'm more than happy to do that.
Well, I am glad. And for everyone tuning in, make sure to follow Richard and check out his content if you need help on a valuation side. As a business broker, you want to learn more. As a business owner, you have questions and things like that. Check out Richard's stuff.
Right. They can also find me on LinkedIn where I post fairly often. They can maybe pick up some different things there or take a look at the newsletter.
And I love it. And it's fascinating because if you look at what Rich is putting out there, it doesn't seem to fit semi-retired, but I know that's the mode he's trying to be in. And so I appreciate it. So yes, thank you for being here, Rich.
Thank you.
And for everyone tuning in, as you know, we will see you in the after show. He and I are going to talk about a lot of great stuff. But until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.